This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There's a moment early in George Packer's new book where he writes, quote, "What do we see? An unstable country, political institutions that might not be perpetuated, a people divided into warring tribes and prone to violence." It's the kind of searing insight that Packer brought to years of reporting on Iraq after the U.S.'s 2003 invasion, when Packer wrote, quote, "Either the people melted away or the institutions were melted down by them." And, quote, "The vote magnified ethnic and religious divisions. The contest was more and more among Iraqis themselves." That's from Packer's 2014 book, The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. His account of U.S. folly in believing that it could democratically unite a divided nation via Tomahawk missile, private contractor, and Humvees. But let me go back for a second and read that very first quotation to you again, the one about the unstable country. Where is it? Because the first time I didn't actually read the quote in its entirety. So here it is. Quote, "What do we see in the mirror now? An unstable country, political institutions that might not be perpetuated, a people divided into warring tribes and prone to violence. The kind of country we used to think we could save. No one is going to save us. We are our last, best hope." That is from George Packer's new book, where he has trained his eye homeward, and the book is called Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. And George Packer joins us today. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much, Meghna.
Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, is also with us as well. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, George. I read your essay in The Atlantic aloud to my wife. We relished every word. And when we came to your one-paragraph sentence, I don't much want to live in any of these Americas, we cheered. So two cheers from us.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to be with you again, Jack, because I think we met many years ago in Boston. So thank you both so much for having me on the show.
Sure. Well, I'm actually going to sit back a little bit and definitely listen to the two of you in detail this hour. And we'll talk about those four Americas that Jack just hinted at. But the first thing I wanted to start with, George, if I could, is how strong are those echoes that I sort of I teased out from your work in Iraq? We're looking at verging on 20 years ago now. And this very nation, the United States today.
Well, last year I wrote an essay for The Atlantic called "We Are Living in a Failed State." And the headline got a lot of attention. I didn't mean it literally. I have reported on failed states, Iraq, Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, places where the state is simply not present or is actively a force of destruction against its own citizens. We're not there. Last spring, at the worst moments of the pandemic, you could still get an ambulance to the hospital if things went right for you, if the hospitals had a bed for you. The police were functioning in some way. Social Security checks were being mailed out. So it wasn't as if the state had collapsed. But what happened last spring was that our government, our national government, sort of abandoned us to our fate in the face of a once a century pandemic. It had no plan, it had no structure, and it seemed to have no desire, as if it didn't care whether we lived or died. And so that gave me the sensation I've had in some of these other countries, less fortunate countries, that there's no state here to take care of us or to even do minimal things. We're not nearly as far along as others, but the worst thing is to imagine we can never move in that direction, because we've had a functioning government for centuries, and because we're used to a certain level of comfort. We should never imagine it can't happen here. It is happening here. And I wrote Last Best Hope both to point out how far along we came last year toward a real collapse of self-government, and also how much it's up to us, because there is no foreign power that's going to come in and either make things better or worse here. We're on our own.
You know, as I read through the book, and Jack and I were talking about this yesterday, there are strong echoes of a great tradition of writing about this country. And it starts, I would say, right at the very first sentence. It's almost Melvillian, if I could say, where you just chose to start the book with the simple declaration, I am an American, period. Why was it important for you to start that way?
I want to identify myself with this country and all of us with this country. And then to immediately the next sentence, as you know, Magna, is no, I don't want pity. In other words, this is not chest beating, flag waving, USA, USA chanting. This is a kind of sober, as I say, middle-aged look at ourselves, as we have reached a point that I think is one of the low points in American history. And to be both honest about it, as one has to be honest in one's own life about having reached maybe a bad place, and also to try to imagine an identity that we can embrace, that is an America we want to live in. Just as in your own life, it's not enough to say, man, I'm in a bad place. You also have to say, who do I want to be? And what can I build on? What characteristics do I have that I can still say that's something that gives me a way into the future? Yeah. So that's what this book is about.
Well, we're going to get to the sort of the four Americas you identify. But let me turn to Jack here, because he is our in-house encyclopedia of great American writing here. And Jack, actually, you were pointing out yesterday that Packer's book, Last Best Hope, you see it as falling into a kind of tradition about Americans, or actually even sometimes international writers looking at this country.
Well, yes. I mean, it reminded me of George's use of ideal types, these four Americas, where he boils it down and says, you know, this is to essence. That's a procedure that is identified with Max Weber, the German theoretician whose book on the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism really sort of pioneered this way of looking at reality. Boil away all the accidental things and the complications and look at the essence of a type of something, an ideal type. And it's a dandy journalistic device that's fallen into disuse, and I think George uses it very well indeed here. Of course, to each of these types, and we're going to get into it, one can say, well, you left this out. Mm. But, of course, sometimes that's the point of the type, to leave out the contradictory data.
Right, the distillation being the point. And it's, George, in a few minutes, a little later in the show, we're going to talk about who you read in the process of writing this book during this last pandemic year. But let's dive into the Americas that you lay out here. I'm calling it sort of a new taxonomy of America.
Right.
There's real America, as you call it, free America, smart America, and just America. Real America. Start with that. Who is real America?
So these are narratives. I don't see them as groups, although some groups adhere to the narratives more than others. But I don't want our listeners to think I'm simply describing everyone in the United States as falling into one of four types. These are the dominant ideas yeah. of the country in the last generation, let's say. And other ideas that we could talk about later that have not been dominant and maybe need to come to the fore are left out of this taxonomy. Real America it's a phrase Sarah Palin used in 2008 during the campaign. And she was referring to, as she put it, the hardworking, patriotic Americans in towns and rural areas who grow our food and fight our wars. So we know who she meant. She meant white people. She meant Christians. She meant small town folks, folks who work with their hands, folks who work on farms. And it had an invidious quality because it was so divisive. It meant some people are not real Americans, people who live in cities, people who live on the coast, maybe Black Americans, brown Americans, immigrant Americans. She was being categorical in her sort of explosive way in setting us against one another by calling it real America. She said it at a fundraiser, and I've concluded that politicians really tell the truth in front of their donors. They say exactly what they mean only when they're in front of people who are writing checks for them. This became Donald Trump's narrative. Mm. I think there's a direct line from Sarah Palin to Trump. She was his John the Baptist. And Trump took this narrative and really made it the Republican Party's narrative, at least the base of the Republican Party's narrative. The elites in the party had a different narrative, and there's a struggle going on now between the two. But for Trump, nativism, anti-globalization, xenophobia, anti-trade, anti-immigrant, all those things that are conveyed by this kind of exclusive phrase, real America, became Trump's America, and it had an enormous appeal for large numbers of people, enough to get him elected.
Mm. Well, Jack, I'm going to let you jump in here, but we have a minute to go, so I'm going to wait till we get to the other side of the break so I don't have to cut you off. But George, let me just give you 30 more seconds. How, in terms of these four narratives, as you put it, that the United States, you see, has fractured into, how impenetrable do you think these narratives are?
Actually, I think they overlap.
Okay.
And they morph into each other, and they affect each other. They all come from the same society, and that's a key point. We are one society, so all of these narratives in some way shape each other. They are not divided up by concrete walls. They're more like fluid membranes.
Well, we will hear a lot more about these different Americas as George Packer sees them, and we'll hear from Jack as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're hearing from George Packer, the award-winning journalist whose latest book is Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, is also with us as well. And Jack, let's fully dive into it. Give us your thoughts, your reflections on real America, as George Packer describes that narrative, or any of the other Americas that he's brought to the table here.
Well, you know, I think it was in India a couple of years ago after the 2016 campaign, Hillary Clinton was giving a talk, and she said to the assembled people, I carried the prosperous parts of the country. And indeed she did, overwhelmingly. And, you know, my image of that is it's as if someone picked the country up in the middle and the prosperity ran to either coast. And what was left in between is the real America. And that reality, not just sentiment, but that reality of being dispossessed of promise, the promise America makes to everyone, of opportunity for children, of hope even, it seems to me, one of the defining conditions of real America, and it's what sort of commands one's sympathy. At the same time, the the prevalence in real America of unembarrassed racism, xenophobia, you name it, Trump hit all the notes. That makes one qualify one's sympathy and think, well, why do you have to blame someone else for this? Who to blame is a bigger question. But why not blame vast impersonal forces like globalization and financialization and so on instead of, you know, the brown people coming across the border?
Mm. Well, a point well taken that you cannot separate white Christendom from this narrative of real America. But George, let me turn back to you here, because you were saying that these narratives are, they're like membranes, right? They flow out and into one another. And the one that you tie real America actually rather closely to is the concept of free America. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, exactly. That's the right comparison. Free America, I think of as Reagan's America, the America of market fundamentalism, low taxes, deregulation, get government out of my life, and I will be free, and we will have prosperity, and we'll become the shining city on the hill. This was, of the four, I think, the most potent politically in my adult life. And it really has dominated our politics for mm-hmm. decades. But in people's lives, it became more and more of a hollow promise. I mean, whole areas of the country have been hollowed out by both by trade deals and by monopolization of the economy by a few corporations, by all the wealth flowing upward to a few people and a few corporations. And people in small places with, you know, industries that were dying have been really left behind. And so freedom, which had this idea of, you know, let the market, let the invisible hand of the market rule, no longer has that appeal for a lot of Americans. They still use the word freedom, but it means something different. It is less about taxes and regulations and more about don't tread on me. It's an identity. Get off my property. It's the Gadsden flag that we saw waving all over the Capitol on January 6th. It's a more threatening and threatened freedom. It's not optimistic. And so in that sense, real America has inherited some of the terms of free America, but they've been transformed by conditions which have been deteriorating in real America. So free America remains the orthodoxy of the Republican Party. All you have to do is read when they used to have platforms before they stopped doing that. The platform of the Republican Party remained just identical for decade after decade, no matter what the data showed about its effectiveness. And it turned out low taxes did not create more jobs. It did not raise wages. In fact, it had the opposite effect, low taxes on wealthy Americans. So the promises of free America failed, but it remains the mantra, almost like a cargo cult, of the elites of the Republican Party, while the base of the Republican Party has moved into what I call real America, which has echoes of free America, but in some fundamental way has rejected the policy menu of free America.
Hmm. Jack, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, during the last campaign, I think it was Henry Olson or someone like that, one of these think tanks, came out with a survey of opinion, and he basically said that those Americans who buy the free America, worldview, it's about 10%, even if that, maybe even single digits. It's the Wall Street Journal editorial page. It's Republicans when they're at church. It's not. In other words, this is a tiny view of what people want for their country, but it necessitates, because it's so claustral and so confining, and it speaks really only directly to the rich. It has been accompanied by scapegoating to the nth degree. The Republicans have got to lay that on in order to appeal to real America, in order to get themselves into office so they can benefit a free America. That is the Koch brothers and so on. So it sounds like just an economic idea, but it's not. It's not innocent at all of our racial and other stripes.
I think that's right. And I'd add, Jack, that two fundamental trends have created these four fractured Americas, and they've been with us for about half a century. One is the rise of a multi-ethnic, multiracial, what I call a multi-everything democracy, as America has become more diverse and as historically disenfranchised groups have found their voice and their place in our society. And at the same time, we've become economically a more stratified country as the industrial age gave way to the information economy. And now we have inequality like we haven't seen since the Gilded Age and the age of robber barons. And we have our own robber barons today. Those two big trends, I think, have created a sense of competition for status because it's a zero-sum game, and of a sense that we're not equals, that Americans, we've never been equals, of course, but inequality now is so blatant that it creates a lot of friction and social conflict. And I think it's behind a great deal of our ills today.
But if I can just jump in here for a second, I want to come back to something that you said a minute ago, George, about the potency, the political potency of some of the core ideas, the free market ideas in free America, because the reason why it's maintained its power over the political elite, I would say, in this country, regardless of the realities the avalanche of economic inequality that it was pouring on the rest of the country, is because this was a notion that, again, that porous membrane you're talking about was also embraced through the 90s by the Democratic Party as well.
I mean, this is where
otherwise it wouldn't have lasted as long. Yeah,
this is where we get to Smart America. Smart America, I think of as Bill Clinton's narrative. It's the narrative of the educated class, the professional class, who really did become the heart of the Democratic Party, along with non-white working class Americans. And that narrative says that if you get an education and get into the right schools and into the right professions, you'll have a successful life and you will pass it on to your children and they will do the same thing. And in the end, it's open to all talents. As long as there's a certain amount of help, whether it's in the form of child health insurance or affirmative action or things that smooth out the rough inequalities that we all acknowledge, the basic meritocratic system is a fair one, and it will create the best possible society where the intelligent essentially rule. Well, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with it, first of all, is it hasn't really been that. It's more like an aristocratic system where your ticket is punched at birth by who you're born, where you're born and to whom, and what kind of family you come from, and what kind of pressure they put on you, and what networks they have, what connections they have, what work ethic they give you, what you're surrounded by. So the meritocracy, I think, has become a kind of top 15% aristocracy and a new form of inequality. But you're absolutely right. It shares some of the free market tendencies of free America, free trade, open to globalization, and a certain skepticism about too much government. It's a softer narrative, but I think, like free America, it has not made good on its promise.
Yeah, Jack, I want to turn to you back here. I want in just one second, but there was a particular idea in your narrative of Smart America, George, that I just thought was so perspicacious. And that is that you assert that Smart America does not understand I don't want to call it nationalism, but the idea of being an American is so important to members of some of these other narratives that they may feel greater affinity to, you know, smart Britain, let me put it that way, or the smart classes of the rest of the sort of global meritocratic elite. And they've sort of lost this notion of why identifying with country might be important. Am I reading that in the right way?
You are. You absolutely are. The word I use is patriotism, which I think is a positive value. Nationalism is aggressive and means imposing on others and asserting superiority to others. Patriotism is just loyalty and love of one's own, like family loyalty. I think because Smart America is a cosmopolitan narrative, it's almost inevitable that it's going to have looser ties to a place. There's going to be a lot of mobility, living abroad, connections to people abroad, and a sense of identification, yeah, with educated professionals in Berlin or in Singapore or in lots of other world capitals. And it's part of its attractiveness is that it's open to the world and it's open to the new. But what it lacks is that sense of rootedness in a place. Smart Americans usually leave where they're from and go to one of the cities where the smart American jobs are. And I think what is lost is a sense that most people have instinctively that their part of their identity is wrapped up in their country, and therefore the fate of their country matters in some fundamental way. And it's not just something for technocrats to tinker with in order to try to solve problems. It's actually something more like a spiritual value.
Mm. Jack, come on back in here. I want to hear from you.
Well, I think in one of Plato's dialogues, there's a character who says something like, "I don't belong to the city. I'm the rich. I'm wealthy. I'm above that." And surely there is that kind of cosmopolitanism among this group. There's also a sort of neurosis of credentialism. A friend of mine, a psychotherapist, had a patient who was at the Harvard Business School. And this young woman came to her and was distressed about her relations with her boyfriend. Well, they were both at Harvard Business School, but the young woman was a graduate of Yale, whereas the young man she was attracted to, he was a graduate of the University of Indiana. And she said, "I just can't reconcile that." I mean, the University of Indiana. It's an anecdote, but I think it's a there's painful truth in that about getting the not just the paper, but the right paper and from the right place.
Mm.
Which makes it a huge burden on families. The most important event in their life cycle is the college admission letters. And that's a source of just unbelievable anxiety. And families go to huge lengths and spend a lot of time and money to make sure that those letters come out the right way.
Jack, you know, yesterday when you and I were talking about George's book, you pointed out, and we're acknowledging here in this hour, that these are four narratives, right? They're deliberate distillation, so therefore they're not going to, by design, have some of the complexities that that America is rife with, some of the amazing complexities that America is rife with. And we're going to talk about that in a second about why the distillation matters. But you know, you had some stories yesterday, Jack, of maybe counterexamples within these narratives that I thought were really compelling. Could you bring one of them to the conversation here?
Oh, well, to jump ahead, Just America is basically the woke America, to use the Republican or the conservative shibboleth, woke America. We all know what that is, or we think we do. And its emphasis on oppression and on people of color as victims and as the whole of American history just waiting on them. Jesse Jackson spoke to this sense in the 1988 campaign. He said, "Grievance is too heavy a burden to bear. You have to turn around and look back to pick it up. Then, when you're carrying it, you can't go forward." I think he put his finger on the debilitating side of focusing on the damage that American history has wrought upon African Americans, and not enough on the resilience and the strength. And as an example of that, I heard a story about the USS Lansdale, a destroyer, World War II. There were two, all-white crew, two black mess boys, as they were called, were on the members of the crew, and they asked the executive officer, can you show us how to shoot the guns, you know, how to man the guns if we have to? He asked the captain. The captain was a racist. He said, no, we wouldn't let those people near the guns. But the captain was a drunk. He was off the ship a lot. And sure enough, the exec did teach them how to man the guns. Well, off the Libyan coast, they were attacked, the Lansdale was, by a swarm of German planes. Bomb strafed, the ship is sinking, and who are manning, the only people on the ship still there, are those two African-Americans manning the guns, and they shot down two German planes. Mm. That's the other side of the African-American experience, the strength, the endurance that comes from suffering.
Mm. Well, we're going to hear a lot more about what George Packer calls just America when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next week on the show, we're bringing the money ladies back, Michelle Singletary and Rana Faruhar, two of our favorite guests who talk about the micro and the macro of this economic moment in the United States. And we're going to focus on the fact that we are seeing historic numbers of Americans quitting their jobs, 4 million in April alone, to find better work or for a variety of reasons. But it's a historic number. So we want to hear from you about this. Did you quit your job recently? And we want to know why. What changes would your company or your organization have to make in order to entice you to stay? Let us know. We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Your chance to ask questions of the money ladies next week. Today, we are having a fascinating conversation with Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, and with George Packer as well, the award-winning journalist whose latest book is Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. And George, before the break, Jack gave us a kind of a counterexample to the narrative advanced by what you call Just America. So first of all, tell us a little bit more about what Just America is, because this is the one narrative that's brought you particular grief from critics on the left.
Yeah, no surprise there. So I think of Just America as parallel to Real America. They're both populist rebellions from below against the failures of the more elite narratives that had been in place. And so chronologically, they come later. Just America, I think, is quite recent. Obviously, social justice has been a passion and a thread throughout American history. But I think really since about the year 2014, a certain version of social justice has become extremely powerful in some of our cultural institutions like media and academia and the arts, and more in politics. It's dominant. What is Just America? Jack began to describe it a bit before the break. Mm-hmm. It's a view that rejects the idea of incremental progress toward a more perfect union, which was a phrase Barack Obama loved to use. And in a way, it's a bit of a rejection of Barack Obama himself. It says, no, we are not making progress. In fact, there's a sort of stasis, a stagnancy to American history, so that you can draw a straight line from slavery through Jim Crow and the era of redlining, et cetera, to the present, to the second class status that so many Black Americans still hold today as citizens of this country. And so in a way, it's Faulkner's line, the past isn't dead, it isn't even past, which is why there's so much attention in our culture right now to periods from the 19th century, Civil War, segregation. It sees, philosophically, it sees people in as members of groups and groups as either oppressor or oppressed. And a key word for just America is caste. Caste meaning a permanent hierarchy of groups in which some are above and some are below. So it has a kind of monolithic view of individuals as members of identity groups and identity groups as in this kind of permanent state of conflict between the oppressor and the oppressed. It was in the streets last summer in the social justice protests that followed the murder of George Floyd. And it's in our schools, and it's in a lot of the culture wars today are about the claims of the narrative of just America.
And you object to those claims because they would look at American history as being rife with factual truths about those power imbalances.
Well, can I read a couple sentences,
please,
from the book that will answer that?
Yeah.
And this is really about how we see American history. We know that facts matter. Trump taught us how essential it is to have a basic shared reality in facts. But facts have to take us somewhere, to some moral identity, to some version of what kind of country we want to be. So here's a short quote. America is neither a land of the free and home of the brave, nor a bastion of white supremacy. Or rather, it is both, and other things as well, changing all the time and yet somehow remaining itself. Whether you see it as one or the other or something else altogether is not a neutral observation. It's a choice. Every choice satisfies a desire. In other words, I think in the end, we're not arguing over the facts of American history. We're arguing over what we want to emphasize. And I become impatient with the orthodoxies of both the right and the left mm-hmm. when it comes to what to emphasize. I think both of them are rigid and in some ways intolerant and can't allow in counterexamples or inconvenient facts and instead want it to be all one thing or all the other. When American history is so rich and so complex and so full of stories like the one Jack told before the break.
You know, so the reason why I found these narrative distillations to be very edifying is because I hear you making the argument that even though these are narratives, the problem, the existential problem that the United States as a nation is facing right now is that many millions of people are dwelling quite happily within the confines of those narratives. And while you're saying that they're porous membranes between them, I don't think people actually feel that way. Because what's so fascinating to me is the word America is in all your narratives, but I think people in living their daily lives are focused on the real, the free, the smart, and the just, and not so much where you start your book, which is, I am American, full stop, right? And so the reason why I say that is because, like, we're getting some quite interesting comments coming through online. And for example, a listener calling themselves Freedom to Be says, I have zero plans to unite with terrorists, their supporters, racists, or Confederates. Thanks anyway.
So, I'm not asking you to do that, and I wouldn't do it myself. There are certain things in our society today that are beyond the pale, and one of them is the use of violence for political ends, and one of them is racism as a view, as a way of dealing with other human beings. And one of them is lying and being unable to accept facts and to have some basic shared sense of what's real and what isn't. Those things are all they all are completely destructive of democracy. And there's really not much to say to someone who refuses to accept those terms. So that's not, yeah, I'm not talking about joining forces with terrorists.
But George, can I just jump here for a second?
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Because the reason why I find that comment to be so interesting, I can't tell for sure. It's just I've heard a lot of similar stuff that it's those are the words that people, some people use to describe what you talked about as free America or real America, but they transmute those same narratives into racist terrorists and their confederates, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm getting.
Yeah, and it's disturbing because we've now taken on this language that demonizes people who we actually have to live with. We're stuck with each other. My basic feeling after the election, aside from relief that we didn't have a second term of Trump, was we are a divided country and we're all stuck together here. We can either have a war or we can try to have a peaceful separation or we can figure out what makes us all part of the same country. So if anyone you disagree with is a terrorist and a racist, that's a step in the wrong direction. And I'm afraid our political and media elites play a part here in pushing us into these extremes and into this kind of vicious terminology. Whereas I think the behavior of a lot of ordinary Americans who are not on Twitter shows that there's actually more fluidity and a little more tolerance. For example, the results of the election last year should have been a complete shock to the political and media elites. Trump's support among white men was the only group that went down. His support among black men and Latino men went up. That was so out of sync with what you would imagine to be the case from reading a lot of journalism and especially social media, that it shows you that maybe the prisons that we've built for ourselves are the problem, right, as much as any real deep divisions, which are there, but which may not be as insuperable as we sometimes think.
So, Jack, let me turn back to you because when I heard George say that he's quite fed up with any and all of the orthodoxies that are described in these four narratives, I say hear, hear, but just to be crystal clear, some of the most vicious anti-democratic orthodoxies that are striking at the heart of this democracy, we've focused on the left here a little bit, but are coming. They are coming from the elites, I should say, on the right, who are exploiting the narratives of free America and of real America.
Yes, there's gold in them there categories. Mm-hmm. There's just no question about it. I saw the other day that Sean Hannity earns about $47 million a year. So that's his incentive, and people are plugged into that. But, you know, on the other side, they've allowed themselves to be plugged in. It's so easy when talking about these people on the right to eliminate agency. You know, you choose. If they're exploited, it's permissive exploitation. If you turn on Fox, you choose to do it. You're not just a gull. You're not just a sucker of it. I wonder if I could just ask George a question. You raise, when talking about just America, you talk about the danger of, quote, elite overproduction, mm-hmm, and how this has led to violence in the past. That's sort of your dark moment in the end. And then you go to a lighter moment where you talk about equal America. Can you help us there? What is elite overproduction, and why is it threatening to us now?
It's a phrase of the historian Peter Turchin, and he looks at history and finds that social conflict, upheaval, often accompanies a period where there's a lot of overeducated, underemployed people who are prepared for high-level jobs and find that those jobs don't exist or they're really hard to get. That certainly describes journalism. You guys know that. It describes a lot of the professions today. And so Turchin sees, and I'm basing my analysis on his, Turchin sees the social conflict we see today, including, I think, some of the rigid shibboleths of Just America as a symptom of overproduction of elites, of young people prepared for an elite life who find that the elite life is not available to them and rebel against the very institutions that they've been trying to get into. Equal America is my shot at a fifth narrative, mm-hmm, one that I think is more attractive and more encompassing. And it goes back to Tocqueville, who said the thing that makes Americans most distinct from Europeans is the passion for equality, the desire to be as good as everyone else, which is something, it's not the same as the ideal or the fact, it's the desire. And that has run right through American history like a bright thread. I think it's still with us today. And I think when it goes unanswered or stifled, we have trouble, we have conflict. And I think Biden, you could say, has stumbled almost in his somewhat doddering way on equal America as a guiding philosophy for his policy agenda. And to me, it's the most attractive and the one likeliest to pull us away from the brink that we're on now.
Well, we have got a comment from Karen Reeves on Facebook who says, understanding the other side is not the same as agreement, but it may be essential if we are ever again to have the ability to find reasonable compromise and avoid a repeat of our recent struggle. Implying that those who disagree with us aren't true Americans won't help get us there. Now, Jack and George, I want to, in the last few minutes, sort of close with this question. So how do we get to equal America? And the reason why I ask is because, you know, the pandemic was a kind of shock, an eye-opening shock. The scales fell from the eyes of many millions of Americans about the reality of this country. Trumpism, for many Americans, also a shock. But we've been through these shocks before. I mean, George, I was looking at an article you wrote 10 years ago, which was on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And that article was called Coming Apart. It was in The New Yorker. And you said that the main reason that 9/11 didn't become a source of jobs or of ideas for revitalizing the economy was that the country wasn't thinking about its own weaknesses even then. So what could be different now to get us closer to equal America if previous shocks weren't enough?
Yeah, you're getting something important. I think we've been through a 20-year decline since 9/11 with one shock after another. And there are more to come if we don't change course. First of all, there's a policy agenda. It's not mine. It's well known. And I think it's finally beginning to have some play in Washington. It's essentially give workers more power, give them more money, rebuild the safety net so that people's daily existence isn't simply a struggle for survival, which makes being a productive citizen almost impossible. Attack monopoly, which holds so many people in states of inequality and unfreedom, and break up monopoly where it deserves to be broken up. And in education, find a way to change the financing base of our schools so that the quality of your school doesn't entirely depend on the zip code where you live. These are basic things. They've been around for a long time. But I think we're finally beginning to see how important they are, not just for our economy, but for our democracy. And that's the other side of it. Self-government depends on a sense of equality in this country, which is the basis for a feeling of shared citizenship. Self-government is an art we've lost. And to regain it, I think we need to rebuild our skills as citizens. Journalists have a role to play here. And I think one way journalists can play their role is by remembering the story isn't about them. The story is about the Americans out there who they need to listen to, especially those Americans who don't sound or look like them.
Well, George Packer's latest book is Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. And as we said at the beginning of the show, Packer says, George says, no one is going to save us. We are our last best hope. Thank you so much for joining us today, George.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, always a privilege to listen to you, Jack. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.